Right. My name's Eric Holder. I taught history from 1961 until 1997, involved in the various initiatives and through that period, like team teaching, schools council history, as it was called in those days. I was heavily involved in field work, especially towards the end of my career.
Please, can you tell me a little bit about yourself first, your home background, your parents and your own schooling?
Right. I was born on the 10th of October 1940 at my paternal grandparents' home because my father was in the Royal Air Force at the time, and my mother went to live at her in-law's house. It was a household with about four generations in it at the time. There was my great-grandfather, an elderly auntie of my grandmother's. There were my grandparents, my mother, myself and my brother. And inevitably, I tended to ask my great-grandfather and the elderly aunt about the olden days, which I always had a fascination with. I don't know where that came from, except that great-grandfather had been born at sea in 1862 and had a fascinating life, left the sea and set up a glass factory in the nearby town of Nottingley, and he and the elderly aunt had a lot to say about the olden days, which to me were just an amorphous sort of thing rather than an extended history as we understand it now. Aunt Maria, as she was called, the old pronunciation Maria, could remember the collapse of the Tay Bridge, and she never failed to tell me about it because I always prompted her, because both my brother and myself were fascinated by ancient disasters, especially as we had to cross a canal bridge nearby quite regularly. And I suppose it was that got me interested in history. When we moved to Pontefract, I failed my 11 plus on two occasions and ended up at secondary modern school. The third try, the 13 plus, I failed, but I also passed at the same time for the technical college, and as a result I had a choice between the grammar school and the technical college. And because my father had attended the grammar school and his brother, my brother, was there, I opted for that. And there I found that history was very different to what it had been in the secondary modern. The secondary modern teachers were enthusiasts, and one of them had been a pilot in the First World War. Fascinating, because we could get him talking about it. And in the grammar school it was nearly all dictated notes, and that was quite off-putting, but it didn't put me off history. And really that's it as regards background, except that at the age of 17, when I was in sixth form, I joined the local archaeological society. I'm now chairman.
So it's been a lifetime.
Yes, yes. I wrote the 50th anniversary book about the society.
Jolly good. Why did you decide to become a history teacher?
Well, it was my second choice, to be honest. My first choice, I wanted to be an archaeologist. And the headmaster, who was the only careers advice we had at the grammar school, told me quite bluntly I wasn't bright enough to be an archaeologist. He was an Oxford man, and I think he thought that you had to be Oxbridge to be an archaeologist, and I took his word for it. And my second choice was to go to training college and teach history, which I did. I just did it, basically. I got in at my first attempt at the first choice college of three at Leeds, and I found actually that I rather enjoyed putting it over to people. Before I went to college in 1959, I did what a lot of sixth formers in those days did. The local authority asked me to teach in a primary school for a couple of terms. And I was lucky enough to be in a primary school where a distant relative of mine was a form teacher, and he asked me to do a lesson on local history to his what we nowadays call 11 plus class.
Wow.
and there was far too much information in it, as you do to begin with, and I found I liked it, and that was it, basically. I was hooked.
Good. When you went to Leeds, to the City of Leeds Training College, what sort of training did you have?
It was very good, I think. I was one of the... there were probably about a third of us that had some experience. And 90% of us, the men, had been in the forces. I hadn't. I'd missed it by 10 days. I'd had the medical for the forces, but I was in the first batch. In fact, the call-up finished for people born on the 30th of September 1940, and I was the 10th of October. So I was lucky in a way, although I always count myself unlucky, because I think it would have done me good. It was excellent training in a way. We did history in some depth. We did secondary subjects, and everybody did English. What I didn't like, we did PE and games as well. I was never thrilled with that. Although we actually found that Brasher, the man who paced the 4-minute mile, was visiting Carnegie College next door for his training. So we all made a point of going there and running round with him so we could say we'd trained with Brasher. We never did, of course, but didn't train with him. We just were on the same track, but it was quite fun. School practices, a lot of people dropped out after the first one.
Because it was so tough.
But, yes, and it wasn't in those days, but of course we didn't realise then. It wasn't tough at all. But two people who I knew who dropped out both went and joined the police in Kenya, who were fighting the Mau Mau because they reckoned it would be easier than teaching. I think they may have had a shock about that, but it was lucky for me because I'd been a day student until then, and there were now some places in Hull. So at Christmas I moved into Hull. We had field work, we went out on expeditions, and we were taught by some very nice people.
Did you have some element of archaeology within that training?
Not really, no. Except that by then I was excavating at Pontefract on a priory site as part of my amateur work. And the one of my history tutors knew the man in charge from Leeds University, and that helped in that I had that sort of personal contact one place removed, really. And a friend from college used to come over at the weekends. We stayed at home and excavated over the weekend and then went back to college, and he stayed with archaeology with his pupils, as I did, actually.
Did you find on your teaching practices that there was enough support for dealing with the difficult children?
Never enough, no. Having said that, I still think that you've either got it or you haven't. And I've seen some really highly qualified people in school who were hopeless, and some, in fact, the best best disciplinarian I ever taught with was a lady who had no qualifications at all and was forced out to go into the prison service because she didn't have any teaching qualifications. And she was a disciplinarian of the sort that she never had to raise a voice, never, or do anything. The children just sort of did what she wanted and loved it. I wish I was as good as that, but I've known one or two like that.
So when you qualified, you went to Castleford to
Yes.
secondary school.
Yes.
Was that a comprehensive school? Or?
Oh, no, there were none then. Not in this area. In fact, I think there were only about two or three in the country. It was a secondary modern, a typical one. And in fact, I met Joan there, so in a way, it was a very good move. She was a first year at the same time, a first year teacher. There were about six or seven of us, and it was a typical secondary modern. The head had just retired, we'd had a temporary one for a term, and then we got a chap called Bowes, who was a friend of the playwright, the chap who wrote Kes, I've forgotten his name, Barry Hines, a personal friend of Barry Hines, and so we were able to meet him and not so much mingle, but realise that there was a sort of separate culture in the secondary moderns. which was a good one, I think, looking back on it. I enjoyed it to a great extent, because there were, you wrote your own syllabuses, you did what you wanted. Although I did have a shock, I was supposed to be doing local history, and we were in Glasshoughton, which is 2 miles from Pontefract, and I was telling them about Pontefract Castle, and somebody said, "That's not local, sir." Which, of course, it wasn't in the strict meaning of the sense, within 100 yards of the school, which they thought was. It was great fun in that respect, and some of the people I taught there, one girl in particular took the same course I did. She passed a transfer to the grammar school and ended up teaching, in her case, primary. She's just retired, of course. We also taught people who ended up famous as rugby league players. Neil Fox, captain of England. I think John taught him. I think it was a teeny bit too late for me, but I'm not sure. But of course, there were always sporting heroes in the school, but we didn't know that we were going to be great, obviously. It's later, actually. The only person I taught who ended up really famous, I knew he was going to be, he's the editor of the comic Viz now. I taught him at the grammar school, and it was clear he was a genius at cartooning.
I wanted to ask you, you're making up your own syllabus for history.
Yes.
Where do you start? What did you put in it? Were you influenced by other teachers, or have you been taught at training college, or what?
Well, in those days, I was right at the bottom. I had to teach the existing head of history syllabus, but he allowed us to interpret it as we wanted. And so I did it as I wanted to, with plenty of local in it. In fact, that was my brief, actually. We weren't employed as teachers of a subject, we were employed as teachers, and we were lucky if we got our own subject. I did mainly maths and English for my first 2 or 3 years, and the history was a bonus. It was only in my second appointment that I went as an actual history teacher.
Was that to a secondary modern school?
That was a secondary modern school, Airedale County Secondary, and I went there simply because we were overstaffed, all with new teachers. There were a group of 6 or 7 of us. I was the unlucky one, the surplus to requirements. I ended up at a place called Airedale High School, which was classed as a tough school in those days. And I've been promised that whenever a vacancy came up, because I'd been moved on my contract, basically, they would give me the chance. And about 6 months later, we'll be in Featherston. North Featherston County Secondary School had a vacancy for a history teacher, nominally head of department, but only just out of college by 2 or 3 years. I didn't get the allowance to begin with. But I was nominally head of department, and I actually wrote my own syllabuses. The head was an ex-history teacher, and he taught for me.
Was there just the two of you teaching history?
Apart from students, we always had a fair number of students, and he was so enthusiastic, he went on all the courses. He sent me on courses. I enjoyed courses, actually, but he went on them all, and he became a bit too enthusiastic on team teaching. At one point he said, "Right, we're going into this team teaching, it's the latest." The team was himself, me and a student, and we had the whole of the first year group every Friday afternoon, I think it was. And
how many students is that?
Now there were only, the whole school had only about 170 children in it, so divide that by 4, and before we had fifth form, of course. It's not many, but on my own, because the student looked to me, he was busy all the time on his admin and everything, so I ended up team teaching. And we were lucky in a way, because the school was very close to a Roman road, and I made sure we went out looking at the crops as they grew over the Roman road, or didn't grow where the paving was and everything. And we had a good time, actually. I hope the kids enjoyed it. I'm sure I did. But of course the marking was, when you have a whole year group to mark, but at least the student could help with that.
So what syllabus were you actually following? What was the content in each year?
Now, off the top of my head, I can't really remember very well, but I think it would be prehistoric and Roman and Saxon the first year, medieval the second, Tudor Stuarts and the 18th century the third, and the final year, as it was in those days, brought us up to the beginning of the First World War. First World War wasn't really considered history then, simply because a lot of people could remember it. And in fact, some of the people I was teaching with were veterans of the First World War in my early days. So they considered it current affairs. Which I consider the Second World War current affairs, really. I think it should be taught as a separate subject, that period, personally.
So the older pupils, they weren't preparing for any exams then?
No, there were no exams. Bright children were transferred to the grammar school sixth form. I had a fair number that do that over the years. I get very angry and I write letters to the papers from when you hear politicians saying that in the old system with secondary moderns, you were consigned there with no way out. There were plenty of ways out if you had the ability. Technical college, three chances at grammar school in your earlier years and then another one for sixth form. I think the slandering a system which had to put money into it instead of abandoning it would have worked rather better than the present one, because we had the technical colleges, which they're talking about bringing back now, and they were really good. Those boys and girls that I was teaching, the top end, a lot of them ended up there.
When would they transfer to the technical college?
At the end of the second year, basically 13 plus, the same time I went to grammar school. And they ended up earning more than I ever did. A friend of mine who was just been speaking to on the phone, he went to technical college, ended up in the mines as a mining surveyor, and he finally ended up as head burr engineer or something in a big northern city, and his pension is more than my final salary was. I took the wrong course if it comes to money, but I've enjoyed it, I must admit.
How was it regarded, history, in the secondary modern school?
Well, not very highly, except, of course, at Featherston, the head was an ex-history man, so he always gave us priority, but never very much money. His philosophy, which I tended to follow, was that if you know your subject, you don't need that many textbooks. And we used a lot of worksheets, which were pretty crude in the early days. And a lot of it came from the top of your head and enthusiasm. And the great thing was that with no exams at the end, if you got a red herring that was relevant, you followed it. The kids thought they were leading you astray and they were learning something. I loved that. I tended to do it all the time, even when we weren't doing exam courses.
So did you actually set exams for the children?
Oh, yes, yeah. We set exams, we had them now then twice a year, and of course reports. Looking back, I think we had standards easily as high as they have nowadays, because the heads in those days always insisted on correct English and correct speech. Nowadays, well, I'm saying nowadays, when I retired, there was less emphasis on English. In fact, you were told to not mark everything, which went against the grain, but it made it a teeny bit quicker.
Did you have textbooks for the children?
Oh, yes, yeah. The favourite was Cavemen to Vikings in the secondary modern school. In fact, I was given a set of those in my last couple of years at King's School, an old set of Cavemen to Vikings.
Was it by, do you remember?
It was an Unwin book, as far as I know, and I should know because the chap who wrote it was one of my tutors at Leeds, at London, when I went for my supplementary certificate. Oh dear. Unwin.
You mean Unstead?
Sorry, yes, you're right, Unstead. I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who wrote it. I think it was Dr. Cowie. Does that ring a bell? He was a big wig in education 40, 50 years ago, and he taught me when I went to London for my supplementary certificate. But the kids love that, even modern kids. It's rubbish, of course, a lot of it. The Roman roads in it are dreadful, and I use them nowadays as examples of how not to, you know, how a theorist reconstructs a Roman road from a description which is nothing like the real thing. But there again, my kids knew what the real one was like, I hope.
It looks like you were using a lot of your local resources anyway.
Yes, yeah. No choice in some cases. And the fact that it was it's ready-made success in a way, because if you can talk about places the kids know and put a time emphasis onto it, and they suddenly realise that where they are actually has a history, in some cases going back 2,000 years in the case of a Roman road, and it went across the fields behind the school, and I could show them it on aerial photographs.
Thinking back to those earliest days, was that the kind of history you enjoyed, where you could take the children out into the surrounding area?
Yes, it was, but it's memory is deceptive, because it's 50 years ago now, near enough, and I tend to forget the difficult bits, like having to have another colleague with you, a female colleague if you're a man, with a mixed class and things like that. Although we didn't always bother about that in those days, nobody else did. And you have to talk about safety, because there was a railway crossing. But of course it was not a problem in those days. Nowadays I'm sure the kids would all have to have luminous jackets or something, wouldn't they? No problem then. And of course you had to clear it with the head, and in the early days you didn't even have to actually give him advance notice. I could just say, I'm taking the class out this afternoon.
So, how about the sort of least enjoyable topics that you had to teach?
A lot depends on your personal interests, but having said that, having been immersed in history, because I've enjoyed it and read loads of historical novels, which is one way, I think, that my daughter became enthused with reading in historical novels, and I suppose I did in a way. The least enjoyable was modern political, and we didn't have to do that until the national curriculum came in. So it never bothered me too much. And eventually, of course, I was head of department and I let somebody else do that.
So when you were at Featherston, did you enter any pupils for the CSEs?
Yes, it started when I was there, and I became very enthusiastic about it. We attended meetings, and I liked it. Well, I'm pretty certain about it. History was the first subject, other than I think biology, to specify fieldwork, and I drew up a lot of that to begin with. Then, of course, all the other subjects jumped on the bandwagon, to the extent that there was then too much for the kids. And it developed into project work, which is very different, isn't it? But we started history field work in this area, in the old West Riding of Yorkshire, in this area. And I used to actually teach courses in it for other teachers on field work.
Did the field work, was that mainly focused on archaeological
It was, but including industrial archaeology, which was very fashionable in the 60s. Somebody had just invented it, and I liked it, as you'd imagine, because of the field work element. And we took children out and did actual work. I've sorted out press cuttings and photographs here somewhere. That is one that I did from Featherston, where we helped to restore an old water mill. And I had an article in the Times Ed about that, but they spelt my name wrong, which is not unusual. Nowadays, Google mixes me up with the Attorney General of the United States.
That's quite flattering in one way.
No, it is in a way, yes, apart from the fact that I'm sure he doesn't know much about history.
Well, that's very nice. 1972.
Yes. they were one of my first classes that stayed on to Farmer Fifth Farm, and the boy in bottom left ended up as chief photographer to the police. Look, one of the big police forces, I think it was West Riding Police Force, he was chief forensic photographer, and he told me he got that from me because I like taking slides of historical topics. So,
Did you use a lot of your slides and film strips that you constructed in class as
Oh,
well?
Yes, yeah, that's why I started doing it, actually. It was way back in the early days of the Archaeological Society. I saw these speakers bringing slides, and I thought, now that's very useful. So I sort of jumped on the bandwagon and started doing it myself. The tragedy, in a way, is that, of course, I had to leave them at the various schools when they paid for the film and everything. So I've only got a representative sample that I took on my own equipment for my own use now. So I've only 30 or 40 left, which isn't much for 40-odd years of work, is it?
No. And you wonder whether subsequent teachers use them.
Oh, I think they probably tipped them out because everybody went digital, didn't they? And I've scanned them onto digital. It's far better than... because I had some really important stuff in a national sense in some schools. I left stuff on Sutton Hoo where I was working as a supervisor for the British Museum in my summer holidays. I left some of that at one school, and I'm sure it's gone out now.
I was going to ask you if you used commercially bought slides as well.
Yes, I bought them in quite a lot at various schools, and film strips. In fact, I contributed to the first school council film strip on Sutton Hoo. There were 4 or 5 of my pictures on that. In fact, I've still got a copy of it somewhere. I've got an acknowledgement. But that's a spin-off in a way, isn't it?
Would you say that the schools you were working in were quite well equipped for history teachers?
Looking back, no, but at the time I was quite thrilled if we had a slide projector. Featherstone, we actually had a movie projector, ex-forces surplus, but a proper one, and we could set up a room as a cinema and hire films, which we did. And the one I remember was about the construction of the M62 and the history that they revealed as they came along, and the projections about how this Trans-Pennine motorway would hardly ever be blocked with snow. It was true, it all came true. It hardly ever is, because it's designed so that the snow vortexes over the carriageway and hardly settles. So it's rare it's closed, although this last winter it was closed a couple of times. But I know that's geography, really, but it's historical now. We also splashed out on tape recorders.
Reel to reel
to begin with, but way back in the early 70s, when the cassette ones came in, I realised you could actually keep one of those over your shoulder and run it on batteries. And that's when I sent out some fifth form girls to record Miss Alexander, the last surviving witness of the Featherstone Massacre of 1892, who saw this happening at the age of 12 and described it. And as it turned out to be a seminal moment for the foundation of the Labour Party, it was very big in Featherstone history, and she lived in the same street as the school. It was wonderful. And in fact, I went back and made my own recording later, but they've now been there in National Archives. The girls involved, I haven't met since I moved to Pontefract, except that one of them ended up as a manageress of a big shoe shop, and I think that's quite... she was probably earning more than me as well.
Oh, that's great. So you had the freedom, really, to do a lot of practical work with children.
And with CSE, you could write much of the syllabus yourself to begin with. But, of course, I was ambitious and I wanted to move to a school that did GCE.
So you then went on to the King's School? No,
I went to Pontefract Girls Secondary first, because we were reorganising in the whole area. the head at Featherstone promised me the head of department in the new comprehensive school, which sounded wonderful, but I didn't like the idea. I liked the old system, to be honest. I'd grown up with it, and I found it was very successful if you played it correctly. And so I went to a girls' secondary school in Pontefract, but Joan had been head of geography until she left to have our family. And so I got head of history there and moved straight on to GCE, which was in a way a culture shock, although I was expecting it.
Was the girls' school a secondary modern?
It was a girls' secondary modern, but we did GCE with the top two sets. We were actually as statistically as successful as the grammar school.
That's very good, isn't
it? No, it says a lot about the 11 plus, doesn't
it? True, doesn't it? Yes.
I know I failed it because I'm a left-hander and my handwriting was dreadful until I went to secondary modern, where the headmaster persuaded me to try his biro, which was a very new thing. And it was wonderful because I didn't make smeary messes on the paper. And I used a biro when I tried it for the final time, and I passed then. I was no more intelligent at 13 than I had been at 11. I think it was my handwriting. I know it's going back, but the 11 plus had a lot in its favour, but it was too honed in on maths and English. And I think the handwriting, in my case, probably doomed me. And other people, because a lot of those children who did GCE at secondary modern ended up in sixth form and just as successful as the girls who've gone all the way in grammar school.
So you're saying the girls' school was a bit of a culture shock?
It was, in a way, because it was so nice.
Just girls, you mean?
Well, not just that. It was. It was that. Because girls are more civilised than boys, they certainly were in those days. But also because Featherstone, without me really realising it, was a tough school. I was actually attacked once by a group of boys, two of them. But the head persuaded me not to do anything legally. I would now, but in those days you think about your career and everything. It was tough. The girls' school wasn't, and it was so civilised and so lovely, but there was a lot more work involved. I stayed behind late most evenings just keeping up with the marking, because they wrote so much compared to boys, and normally when you got half and half, one half balanced out the other half, but all girls. And then of course we reorganised there, and I had to choose between at three comprehensive schools, and I chose my old school, the King's, as the best of a bad job, I thought.
How did it turn out?
Well, I ended up as head of history there, but I never got any higher up, and that was simply, I think, because I, when the head there asked me if I agreed in history, geography, economics and something else, and RE becoming a humanities department, so I said history's too important to be lumped in with those, and so the head of geography got the head of humanities. If I'd have said yes, I'd have probably got it, but there we are. I didn't realise, I wasn't politically aware basically, and the head was a politician rather than he was a ex-head of history, actually, at the King's School, my last head. But he got done his degree in, I think, political history. The trouble was there that we were teaching both GCE syllabuses in history, schools council, and I'm trying to think what we used to call it, the modern history syllabus, you know.
Modern world.
And I had two lots that I was supposed to be doing, superintending and writing exams for, plus A-level, and I was doing archaeology GCE as well at the same time, and it was too much.
Was it quite a big school, the King's School?
No, well, for me it was, because we had about 1,000 there. The Featherstone one, less than 200. The girls' school was rather bigger than that. It was probably 500 or 600, and then suddenly to a school that eventually ended up nearly 1,000. It was a shock in a way, pleasant one. Very happy times there, and the colleagues were wonderful, some of whom had taught me when I'd been at grammar school, which was very daunting actually, because I ended up calling them Mr. Because you couldn't get out of the habit of being a pupil even that 30 years had gone by. And seeing the other side of those people, and I found out what that was like, because I ended up teaching with people who'd been my pupils in the past, and they found it just as difficult to mix on a professional level. But that happens to everybody, I'm sure.
I was going to ask you, actually, given that your historical interests do have a geographical turn, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
If you'd ever worked with the geography department and done joint...
Well, Featherstone, I had to teach geography as well, so I was head of that too. And my first allowance was for head of, they called it humanities. So I was in charge and teaching some geography. I always enjoyed that, simply because it ties in so well with some aspects of history.
When you were at King's, at the King's School, and the head proposed, you know, this... pulling together of these various subjects into humanities. What was implied by that? Were you going to deliver courses across the various subjects?
No, I think it was just a way of reorganising the management of the school. It certainly did. It was successful, I think. We always had excellent results.
I'm just moving on to think about the curriculum, and you mentioned the school's Council History Project. Was that already in place at the King's School when you went?
No, there? I had to pioneer it there, which was a problem, because we needed textbooks and the lot. And because of the increased numbers, we had to spend quite a bit of money.
And had you come across School's Council History Project before then?
Oh, I was doing it at the girls' school in my last year there, using it as an introduction, the introductory bit. At the end of the third year, before we moved on to modern world, social and political, and I'd been to the meetings, and I was quite well up in it, and I thought, well, if we don't do it at this moment when we're starting a new comprehensive, we never will. And I got a lot of support from the advisor. He was very supportive indeed, and he did manage to get us some extra money. But having said that, he caused a problem in the end by promising something. I've forgotten what it was now. He promised something and forgot it. He was so busy with all the other schools that were also in the same reorganisation going on to Schools Council. And it was a problem, which we got round, of course. But at the time, I can remember a few sleepless nights. Well, that's the problem with teaching, isn't it? Mm.
So, how did the School's Council History Project work out? Was it successful in the school? Was it popular with the pupils?
Oh, it was very popular. The only person it wasn't popular with was the last head, who come from being head of history at local comprehensive, and his degree was in a pretty certain politics and economics rather than history, as I understand it, and he could never really get his head around it, and he insisted on teaching a course in his syllabus, but he had to help mark exams, because of course with the numbers involved, everybody in the department has to, and I did have problems there, I must admit. Simply because it's a different culture, isn't it?
What's different about the culture?
Different periods. Doing something like the American West, which we did as the option, what else? History of Medicine, which I chose as well. In fact, there was no other choice than History of Medicine. In that time, and of course he had no experience of it at all, and when you come to mark a paper on it, I was old-fashioned in a way, that I always felt that essay questions brought out the ones who were likely to end up at university. And so I always had essay questions as part of the deal. And when you're marking an essay question on something like the history of medicine, you've got to have a lot more background knowledge of it than just to answer the question. And that was always a problem, which I'd have found the same had I had to mark his exam papers. But we got round it. At the time, I thought it was the best option. Thinking back over the years, I tend to think that a chronological syllabus might be better for some children. I like the school's council, and certainly it brought out the brighter children. I know that my own daughter took it. I taught her for it, which was not unusual, because my grandmother taught my father after the First World War. We've got four generations of teachers in the family, from my grandmother to my daughter, you know. I taught my daughter it, and she loved it. I think it was the bottom end of the ability range that found it difficult, with the moving to different periods. Thinking back, I think a chronological approach might be better for kids like that.
And that's what you actually did in the secondary modern school when you were...
Well, it was basically, yes. We started with cavemen and Romans and things, and moved up to the start of the First World War. We never quite got that far because the kids loved Victorians. And to be honest, I did. There was no need before exams were there to rush to reach the end of a syllabus, especially when you were in the summer before you left. A nice summer, you're not trying to push them too hard when there's no exam at the end of it, and they're going to be working within a few months.
Did you find it difficult to motivate them?
At times, yes, and some were never motivated, and never are they? But on the whole, through trial and error in a way, I found the things that worked. I'm trying to think what the one I really love was that really motivated girls, and this isn't particularly in a particular year group, was Mary Queen of Scots and her problems with politics, religion and men. And I could even get boys interested in that. And the gruesome operations in the history of medicine, that was, everybody loved that, boys and girls. Wild West, the boys tended to like better, the American West. But if you do it properly, you can generally get 90% of them behind you. They're certainly... Sorry, is that the bird noise? Is that...
Ready?
Yes, yeah. China, I opted for as well, simply because... when you're starting a syllabus from scratch, when a school is beginning, you do have the money to buy in what you want, and I thought the contrast would be nice. I didn't find that very successful. I didn't enjoy that as much, and that could have been the teaching, although by then there were three of us teaching it. But we all had the same experience. It's not relevant enough for ours.
Do you think it was just too alien to what they were
thinking about? Yes, was. The American West they could always identify with, because they've been brought up on cowboy films, even if they're bad ones. And of course, modern world history they can always identify with for the same reason, they've been brought up with it, but never found it very successful. Although again, the top end always managed to do pretty well, because they could think analytically by the time they were doing it. That's really the... the sheep from the goats thing in a way, isn't it? Thinking analytically, and that's how you choose between the ones, well, you don't choose, but they select themselves, the ones who are going to go to university and the ones who are not. And I'm not saying there's anything different about them, in that we all need everybody in society, don't we? But You've got to allow for that and keep them all interested, even the ones who aren't at the top end of the ability range.
Can I ask you about the national curriculum? Because that came in just towards the end of your career.
It did, yes, and I didn't like it, to be honest. What I didn't like was being dictated to by people who never stood in a classroom and tried to motivate children. What they thought was important may have been, but some of it wasn't. Because when politicians dictate what you're teaching, they nearly always pick something that's got a modern slant or bias. I think the slave trade and the so-called Holocaust, which people at the time never called it that. I worked with people who'd actually freed the concentration camps. They never called it the Holocaust. It's a made-up word created by people later, which actually has an emotive power, has the word. And it implies that it exclusively belongs almost to one racial group. And I think that's wrong, because they were killing everybody. Gypsies, gays, as well as Jews. So, in effect, I think politicians meddling with history is too much.
So, but you had to teach it, presumably?
I did, but although I retired in 97, I had a very serious illness in 93. I collapsed on the day, 2 days before we were due to go back. We had an inspection as well, first full inspection for years, and I ended up with internal bleeding, basically, and quite poorly. I was off for 2 terms, and so my second in the department had to pretty well implement everything, and she got through the inspection very well indeed, very well. Then I went back, but I had to have time off for an operation then, and the head wasn't very pleased because he thought I was a permanent fixture, so he didn't take out insurance for staff absences, and having me away 2 terms and then part of a third in 1 year, I wasn't the most popular person. And from that point onwards, I thought, well, the doctor said, basically, you can't carry on at this intensity. Because I was one of the first people to do desktop publishing on the computers at school. I ended up typesetting the whole of the school brochure for 2 or 3 years in a row at the same time as the exams. Because, of course, it had to be out for the following year. And I was the head of chemistry could do it as well, but he had good excuse, because the head didn't understand chemistry, he understood history. So that was pressure as well. And in the end, I realised that the best thing to do was to get out.
So really, you'd say the national curriculum didn't have much of an impact on you at all?
No. I didn't like it. We got money, support, for textbooks and so on. But having the background I have in the secondary modern system at its best, just before they started running it down, I didn't like that.
When you were teaching at the King's School during the 80s, were you broadly in the first 3 years doing the same chronological throughput from Stone Age to...
Yes, we were. Although I had to reluctantly write out the Stone Age and start with Roman Britain. But I always felt, and I still do, that the most important period is Saxon times, because that's when we came together as a country. Athelstan was the first king of all England, and with a local connection, because of course he met in what is now Pontefract. And defeated the Viking Kingdom of York in a battle at Castleford, which is always handy when you're teaching something that the kids know the exact spot where it happened. It's wonderful, is that? You could say Athelstan stood here.
So at the King's, were you doing the same amount of taking the children out to local field trips? More,
in a way. Partly, I was doing it anyway, and from my own bat, I suggested that we did archaeology GCE, later GCSE, as a sixth form option alongside A-levels. And it was most enjoyable, although we weren't particularly successful for all sorts of reasons. My fault as much as anything. But it was enjoyable. And then we had the discovery of a complete Saxon church and cemetery in the town that my GCE archaeology group were asked to investigate with the local professionals from the county unit. And that really got us a high profile. The head loved that, of course. He gave me every Friday afternoon off with the group, which involved a lot of timetabling in a big school. You can imagine, can't you? And I've got some pictures of it here. There are some of those on there of it. The girls in the orange, yeah. We had the twin daughters of one of the hospital doctors, Indian girls. And when I gave them an equipment list, I said waterproof clothing. They, of course, didn't have this. They come from India. And they turned up in wearing the waterproof clothing in summer. You can imagine it. I presume they wouldn't have been as hot in that as the local children who were used to our climate. But they were working in the sunshine in May in oilskins. They were very successful, actually.
It's a wonderful dig, isn't it? You've got a massive
area. Oh, yes. And in fact, without realising it, the guy in charge of it, Tony Wilmot, is now one of the chief archaeologists at English Heritage. And if any of those kids... He's very nice. I'm still in touch with him. Any of those kids wanted any help, he would still be there for them, I think, as he is for me. Mm. But that led on in 1989, the National Power, you know, we're surrounded by power stations here. National Power bought a moated manor site to use for tipping this dreadful fly ash from power stations, and it had to be excavated first. And North Yorkshire, which is only 2.5 miles from here, the county boundary, North Yorkshire decided to mount a public excavation and ask for schools' input. And I was one of the people who was involved in that. I went actually onto the committee of the excavation as the school's liaison. And we started doing work experience there in the fifth form. So I ended up with huge groups going out, and of course I had to have time off, which involved timetabling ramifications as well. But some of those actually stayed on, a lot of the children stayed on and got paid for being archaeologists through the summer, and some of them came back in the holidays from university, and one or two became professionals, which I'll feel guilty about because they'll never be rich, but they'll be happy, I think. That's that dig at Wood Hall with some of my children on it.
You've got some children dressed up in medieval costumes.
Now, every year at Wood Hall on the dig there, we had an open day. All was themed around one of the periods that the moated manor was involved in, and that was medieval. And I asked them to hang on to the walkie-talkies and the modern crisp packet, because I just like that, the way that you've got the modern, and of course the boots on that girl, who isn't one of mine, but these two are mine. And she stayed on for years as a professional member of the dig. That's her doing a plan. And they were on the press pictures there. And we were on TV. And they...
I'll put it back on again.
Right.
Please carry on.
When Wood Hall set out to be an educational facility in the early 90s, they asked me to write the foreword to the school's booklet, the education booklet, as well as taking the photograph for it, I must say. And that ended up not just in there, it ended up in National Powers, National Magazine. We ended up on TV and the radio, and they all ended up quoting what I said in the beginning there.
That's a lovely example of an interaction between a sort of heritage site and a school, isn't it?
Well, not just a school. We had them from all over the north. In fact, Durham, Lancashire, because there was a proper centre with facilities for them to stay or camp. And we had foreign people on the deep, foreign students. So these kids were mixing with French, East Europeans, just after the Berlin Wall had come down, and students at university, so they could chat with them and find out whether that was the path they wanted or not. Local enthusiasts who weren't educated, everything. It was great. They absolutely loved it.
Did it carry on after you'd left?
Yes, I went back as a professional when I took early retirement out of teaching in 97. I was quite poorly. I went back as the photographer to the dig, chief photographer to the Woodhall Archaeological Trust. It sounded better than head of history at the King's School, but the money wasn't anything like as good. at that stage, I was quite wobbly after all my years, illness and everything. But we finished there in 2001 when the money ran out at North Yorkshire and the power station was supposed to change over to burning biomass fuel, which doesn't produce the ash. The amount that it does produce, I think they make into breeze blocks and things. So there was no need to excavate the site anymore. And the dig closed down. But some of those kids who'd worked with me on that dig, that's one of my pupils as well who stayed on. In fact, they both are from school. They moved with us to a dig on the bed of the River Aire where we were digging ancient boats. From 97 to 2001, so Woodhall we were digging in summer, we were digging the boats throughout the year. In between the work by Arjo Budge, the mining engineers, and they ended up, a few of them, as professional archaeologists.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask you some more general questions. Firstly, about sixth form teaching.
I didn't do very much of that simply because I didn't really start until I went to the grammar school in 77, as far as I can remember. And we reorganised as a 11 to 16 comprehensive 10 years later, just at the time my daughter should have been going into sixth form. And at the same time as my second in the department, Jean, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So it was a very sad time. We lost the sixth form. I lost a very well-liked colleague. And at the same time, I had to find somewhere for my daughter to go to do history because she was going to go to the sixth form college where my colleague who was diagnosed with the cancer had got the job as head of history. And when she was diagnosed, she wasn't going to do... Well, she obviously couldn't. She couldn't teach there. There'd no provision for sixth form history there, so we had to fight somewhere for Vicky to go to do her A-level history, and she went to the local Catholic comprehensive very successfully. But in effect, I only taught sixth form for 10 years, so I'm not really an expert on it, on anything really.
Ask you some more general things. I mean, do you think it's important for history in school to promote a sense of national identity?
I do actually, yes. Without being too jingoistic, I think it's very important because we've got a generation now of young adults who don't actually realise how important our country was, and that's important to know how important we were, because as you know, you can't understand the present or even predict the future without knowing something about the past. There was some, I don't watch quiz shows on TV, but I occasionally see them accidentally, And one young woman was asked, who was Britain's longest, Britain's oldest ally? And this girl said, France. Well, we've been fighting them until fairly recently, haven't we? And that sort of thing, I think, is dreadful. You need some background knowledge, but accurate knowledge. When we were doing things like the Hundred Years' War, we spend a lot of time in France, and I look at French textbooks, and they hardly mention Crécy, Agincourt, and Poitiers, but they do mention the ones we lost, but they're not in ours, because we lost the Hundred Years' War in the end. And I think it's important for kids to know that. Not just medieval, Afghanistan is a case in point as well. We were very unsuccessful in Afghanistan at 3 times in history, but we pulled out with honour and respect because of the way it was handled. And this time I think people haven't got the background to know how to handle it. And it's that knowledge of what's happened in the past, I think, that's important places like that.
You're sort of pointing up the importance of studying the empire there. Is that something that you have taught?
I did teach it because it was, of course, specified. Even though we could write our own syllabuses, we were told that you have to bring in the British Empire.
You mean in the national curriculum?
No, way back, oh. Yes.
Who was telling you that?
Well, people like the head and the local... I don't think West Riding did. They may have done, I'm not sure. But it was taken for granted that you teach things like Clive in India and that sort of thing. Which I did, because I like Indian history. I did before my son married an Indian girl, so we've now got an Indian side to the family. But do it properly and do it fairly, that's the thing. Because we gave a lot to India and we got a lot back. And this knee-jerk reactions to various things happening nowadays don't actually do any favours to people on both sides of the racial, I was going to say divide, it's not a divide, we're all together, aren't we, as evinced by the fact that our son married an Indian girl. We're a multi-ethnic society, and if you're fair to all sides, the history's still fun. And that's important. You've got to make it fun, haven't you? Even for adults. I've been teaching adults since I left teaching. I've done work for the WEA, and I give talks in the evenings all over the country to societies. And I go to these places, and afterwards somebody will come up to me and say, you used to teach history, didn't you? And I'll say yes. And it's nearly always a lady, and she'll say, yes, I can tell. She said, I do as well. And it still comes out when you're talking to adults. It's useful.
Last thing really to ask you was about how highly esteemed history has been during your career. We did mention it just briefly,
yes,
on Second,
yes.
Modern, but
yeah.
If you're looking back over the whole career...
Not very well, to be honest. It was always seen as an optional, not very important. People always said maths and English, latterly the sciences, and I agree that they're all vital, but I think history is just as important as all those. It isn't less important because you get things like these people who just don't understand the past, and then from that they can't. Again, Afghanistan, you've got to understand what's happened there in the last 200 years to appreciate the problems that we're having now and to try and find a solution, which we've done in the past. And had we had modern politicians really gone into that, they might have a better idea. And of course, the whole population, if they've been taught that in history, imaginatively, because it's fascinating what happened the first time in Afghanistan, the whole army being wiped out in the Khyber Pass. And, I love that period, and I always have done. And it isn't really my period, when you read the accounts of the Dr. Brydon, wasn't it the only man who came out of Afghanistan the first time? You read accounts of that and you think, wow. And that's what they've done to us, and they'll do it again if they get a chance. But we sorted that.
Just to finish, If you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and to what age group?
Ah, right. Yes, I've been racking my brains over that, actually, because I did have a copy of the questions. My favourite topic is the Dark Ages. The favourite part of that is the period surrounding the Sutton Hoo ship burial, partly because I was heavily involved in the dig there, the end of the first dig in the late 60s. And I've known a lot of the people who... I knew the people who made the discoveries, all dead now, of course, in my younger days. And that and Beowulf together... in fact, on one occasion, I did a lesson on that to two classes when somebody was away, and the headmaster came in and sat at the back just to take the place of the other teacher who was off. And he was thrilled by it, actually. Now, I do this every year, did it every year. A lesson without any written work at all, just narrative, because I think if you know what you're talking about and you've got the... you sense the level of the kids in front of you, you can spend an hour talking to them without boring them and giving them a lot of information, and they'll think they've had a story at the end of it, which is what it's all about, isn't it? I think.
Thank you very much.